So continuing with the rules for a snataka. Text 92. Let him wake in the muhurta sacred to Brahman and think of the acquisition of spiritual merit and wealth, of the bodily fatigue arising therefrom, and the true meaning of the Veda. So it means we should rise early in the morning in Brahma Horta time. When he has risen, has relieved his necessities of nature, and carefully purified himself, let him stand during the morning twilight, muttering for a long time the Gayatri, and at the proper time he must similarly perform the evening devotion. By prolonging the twilight devotions, the sages obtain long life, wisdom, honor, fame, and excellence in Vedic knowledge. So then, after rising, then using the toilet, cleaning oneself properly, and that, then dressing in that, as we are describing in the Sanatana Goswami describes in the Hari Bhakti Vilas. Then, after that, then one should chant one's japa. Because in the Vedic age, the Brahma Gayatri was the japa. So it wasn't that, like we're chanting, we're just chanting because our japa is the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. So then for us, the Gayatri, we do a very short japa, only 10 of the mantra. But before, then that was the japa of the Brahmins. They would chant 108 mantras, 1,008, like this they would chant. So that would be their japa. So here it's mentioning, then therefore one should chant, not quickly, but for long, a decent amount of japa. And then that will, says here, then the sages say that one will nicely advance his spiritual knowledge. And all material, spiritual, everything, all acquisition will come from that. 95. Having performed the upakarman according to the prescribed rule on the full moon of the month Shravan, or that of Poshpad, Bhadrapad, a Brahman shall diligently study the Veda during 4 months and a half. When the Pushya day, the month of Paush, or the first day of the bright half of Magh, has come, a Brahmana shall perform in the forenoon, the Utsargana of the Vedas. Having performed the Utsarga outside the village, as the institutes of the sacred law prescribe, he shall stop reading during 2 days and the intervening night, or during that day of the Utsarga and the following night. After that, he shall diligently recite the Vedas during the bright halves of the months, and duly study all the Angas of the Vedas during the dark fortnights. So, that after we have what's the upakramana means that then one will start the study of the Veda. So before starting means studying the philosophy and all that. Then one will, there's a ceremony and then they start their Vedic study. Studying the mantras, learning the texts very, very nicely. So they give all the emphasis on the Veda. Then, when the first day of the bright half of the Magh, means just we had before, Saraswati Puja, then at that time, then one will stop studying the Veda. And then one will devote to reciting the mantras on the bright half of the month, means from while the moon is waxing. And then during the 2 weeks that the moon is waning, he will study the Angas, which means Sanskrit, astrology, and the rituals of the deity worship, and all these other branches of Vedic knowledge. So that means a portion of the year, here it mentions 4.5, and if he starts in the earlier one, then it'll be 5.5. Then that is only for the study of the Veda. Memorizing, trying to understand what that all means. Then the other part of the year then is just for studying all the supplementary literatures and reciting the shlokas. Because you have a lot of shlokas. You know, some of them are 8,000, 10,000 shlokas. Yajurveda, I think, is 8, Rigveda 10, like that. The Atharva's 5.5, 6, 7. Yeah. And then the Samaveda's only, I think, 1,300. But one Sama to chant can take 5 times as long as the other Vedic verses by the nature of their chanting. So, like this, one has to maintain them, otherwise one forgets if they're not regularly being chanted. So, in other words, he'll balance between the varieties of study that he's doing. So we see that there's a concentration. One time is just on the most essential philosophical in that. Then there's a portion on supplementary, and then for review. But we see that he's doing one and then the other. Because then the mind can very much fully contemplate. Like you're thinking of one thing, then you're always thinking about it. And different times you'll think of this, different times think of that. Then you're able to really concentrate nicely. But otherwise, try to do too many things at once. And if one is very good at organizing the time, then it works very nicely. But otherwise, then one may find it's a bit difficult, because then the mind has a tendency to, you know, deeply contemplate, and then when there's too many things inside, then it doesn't function properly. <coughs> 99. Let him not recite the text indistinctly, nor in the presence of unqualified men. Nor let him, if in the later parts of the night, if he is tired with reciting the Veda, go again to sleep. Yeah, in other words, he gets up in the morning and then goes back to sleep. According to the rule declared above, let him recite the daily portion, the mantras, and a zealous Brahman who is not in distress shall study the Brahmana and the mantra Samhita. So here is the Brahmanas means someone who's very serious. The Brahmanas then describe how to apply the mantras. See, the mantra Samhita here, the mantra Samhita means the main body of the Veda, where all the verses are. Then you have the Brahmanas, they explain how to use it, how to apply it. So he must study these very, very nicely, because he should know what he's doing. He should be expert in all the rituals, all the mantras that go with them. So because people are going to ask him to come and do rituals for him, do their ceremonies. And if he doesn't know, then he will not be able to properly help them. The Brahmin's business is to be able to help the other people, either in teaching them the sacred text or in performing the duties that are described there. 101. Let him who studies always avoid reading on the following occasions when the Vedic study is forbidden. And let him who teaches pupils according to the prescribed rule do it likewise. Those who know the rules of recitation declare that in... those who know the rules of recitation declare that in the rainy season the Vedic study must be stopped on these two occasions, when the wind is audible at night and when it whirls up in dust in the day. So now this is a list of things that all these things, so many different things that are there, then they disturb the mind. So here, these are important rules for somebody who is interested in getting the fruits of the results of this. Means if you want to get the fruit of Vedic study, means the material fruit, you know, karmakanda, then, or the jnanakanda, then one needs to avoid these times. Because that one desires these results means that one is under the influence of the modes of nature. And the modes of nature at these times do not give fruit. Right? So these warnings, for those who are studying the Veda for the purpose of spiritual advancement and following the sadhana for the purpose of pleasing the Lord, then these rules aren't so important. Though one will generally see for one's own, they're quite practical. Depends on how one lives. But a dust storm comes, it's very difficult to sit there when dust is blowing around, and you know, you need to close your windows and go take things down off the line and all these different things. So it naturally is a disturbance. And then if you have students, especially if they're young students who haven't really like dedicated themselves or committed themselves very seriously to the devotional process, they also get very much disturbed by these. So all these are symptoms that the mind of the person who's studying is going to be, can be easily affected. So when there's lightning, thunder, and rain are observed together, or when large fiery meteors fall on all sides, the recitation must be interrupted until the same hour on the next day, counting from the occurrence of the event. When one perceives these phenomena all together in the twilight, after the sacred fires have been made to blaze for the performance of Agnihotra, then one must know the recitation of the Veda to be forbidden, and also when clouds appear out of season. On the occasion of... preternatural sound from the sky, of an earthquake, and when the lights of heaven are surrounded by a halo, let him know that the Vedic study must be stopped until the same hour on the next day, even if these phenomena happen in the rainy season. But when the lightning and the roar of thunder are observed after the sacred fires have been made to blaze, the stoppage shall last as long as the light of the sun or stars is visible. If the remaining above phenomena rain occurs, the reading shall cease, both in the daytime and at the night. Just generally these things, storms and these others, are also affected by Rahu, so then they disturb the mind. So if one's lit the sacrificial fire at the twilight and these things happen, then one will just wait until it gets dark and then perform the yajna. Or in the morning, if one has lit the fires and one sees this phenomenon in the morning sandhya, then one will wait until the stars disappear in the sky and then perform. Because the yajnas must go on, the sacrifice must go on. It's just showing that at that time there'll be a disturbance. So we can see that there's so much if there's a bad smell, there's a corpse lying around, we hear the sound of great weeping and wailing, people are very disturbed, because as soon as you hear that, then immediately the mind wants to know what happened. Right? When bad smell is there, then the mind goes off from the sacred texts. When one's impure, like that after using the toilet, before he's taken his bath, or after accepting a meal for a shraddha, these times it is not to be chanted. Then during the time when the king is impure through a birth or death in his family, or when Rahu by an eclipse makes the moon impure, is while lying on a bed, while his feet are raised on a bench, while he sits, you know, just kind of like squatting down. When he's sitting, when a cloth tied around his waist and around his knees to kind of hold it back, let him not study, nor when he has eaten, nor during a fog, nor while the sound of arrows is audible, nor during both the twilights, nor on the new moon day, or on the 14th and 8th day of the half month, nor on the full moon day. So like this, it just goes on and on and on. And the village has been beset by robbers. You know, fire alarm. Let's see. One should not study near a burial ground. Cow pen, in a cow pen, because it becomes so absorbed, the cows may step on you. nor in cloth while he's that is impure, not during a dust storm, while the sky is unnaturally red, or while jackals howl, barking of dogs, braying of donkeys, grunting of camels. Never heard a camel grunt. Must be a rare thing. Now, while he is seated, I mean, in a group, big group. Not on horseback, on a tree, means sitting in a tree, on an elephant, right, you gotta watch what you're doing there, in a boat, on a donkey, on a camel, standing on barren ground, in other words, one sits on an asan, or riding in a carriage. Interesting. Let him not never recite the Rig or the Yajra while the Saman melodies are heard. Some say because the Samans are for the Pitris, but then the other is that the Samans are Samaveda. Krishna says of the Vedas he's the three, Veda Traya, but of the three he's the Sama. So the Sama is most dear to the Lord. So when that's being recited, the others should be quiet so that that can be heard. That gives them importance. So we can see from this that there is now, after hearing this, you know, there's so many more without taking permission from the guest, while blood flows from the body, when he's wounded by a weapon. During a battle, during indigestion, after vomiting. So we can see that now this is what is meant, because this is the Veda, right? The Veda is the central point of the Vedic culture, and everything is done with the Vedic mantras. Now these are so many times when one cannot chant these mantras or study them. So now when Lord Chaitanya has given us the process of the holy name, where there are no rules and regulations, at any time, any place, any condition, you can chant and get that benefit. And we can see how merciful is the holy name, how special. Right? We come from the Western culture, we just say, you know, no rules and no regulations. For us, big deal. Well, I mean, our whole life has been no rules and regulations. We eat anytime we like, whatever we want, eat, sleep whenever we want, do anything whenever we want, you know, go anywhere and anytime like this and dress however we want. And then, you know, what's the big deal? I mean, it's our whole life has been that. But we see here in the regulations, because all these things, if you think about each one of them, then there's the mind cannot concentrate, right? When you've been wounded or you're being attacked, or, you know, it's very hard to concentrate. So the Vedas demand full concentration. That's why the Brahmanas would be the ones who would study these things, teach these things, absorb them, because that was their only meditation. Kshatriyas learned them when they're young and could sit down to a sacrifice and that, and but otherwise they absorbed themselves in management, in administration. Vaishyas absorbed himself in business. The Shudras absorbed himself in art. So then it makes it very difficult to complete, to have that concentration. Because here is the top, so it must be given full priority. So the holy name is so kind that at all of these times when one would not recite the Veda, you can chant the holy name. Like when you've been cut by a weapon, then you start chanting. But here, the Vedas, you must stop. So we can see how much more merciful is the holy name. Therefore, he is independent. Right? Means the other mantras have their effect when you have concentration. Purity and concentration. Then they can have their effect. Right? They're very, very refined mantras. So very technical, or how you say, specialized mantras. But the holy name, even whether you're thinking or not thinking, benefit is there. One is uplifted. If one thinks in so much more benefit, and even if one doesn't think, even one jokingly chants, then so much benefit is there. So this is a very, very important, I mean, otherwise I wouldn't have read all these, but just to give you an idea of when it says, tatarpita niyamita smaranena kalaha, there's no rules. It means one thinks, okay, one or two rules. No, here, we've gone through now, how many pages? Here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 pages. It means that 25 verses just describing all the times when one can't chant or when one must discontinue the study or teaching. So we can see how merciful and how powerful is the Holy Name and how independent He is. That whatever the situation, then He works. He does not worry about all these things. Mention, okay, then 128, that after the study. In other words, it says the essence is when he is impure or the place is impure. In other words, all these other things make the place impure or himself. That then the recitation of the Veda is stopped. But for the chanting, that doesn't matter. At any time, place, one can chant. Then 128, twice born man who is a snataka, shall remain chaste on the new moon day, on the 8th lunar day of each half of the month, on the full moon day, and on the 14th, even if they fall in the period proper for conjugal relation. So these days should be avoided, even though when one is calculating the time of conception, proper auspicious times for conception, then these days should be avoided. The new moon, the full moon, the 8th and the 14th days. Because they don't give proper results. So the whole idea is that one is, according to religious principles, one is calculating when to have a child. So that means one wants to pick a proper time, a proper auspicious time, and you know, and one that will give, how you say, be favorable to the kind of child that one wants. The one is thinking that this is the kind of child that is wanted, these kind of qualities. So different auspicious occasions then are more naturally suited for these. And then, how you say? Yeah. So then one will be, try to establish in these, but these days themselves, even if they fall within the proper times, these should be avoided. Then 129, let him not bathe immediately after a meal, nor when he is sick, nor in the middle of the night, nor frequently dressed in all his garments, nor in a pool which he does not perfectly know. Right. So after eating, the fire of digestion will go out. When he is sick, also one has to be careful. Sometimes when sick, one may only take half bath or just, you know, with a damp cloth. Depends on the situation, depends on the season, depends upon what is the disease. Nor in the middle of the night, because at that time it's very cold and, you know, it's the time for resting. Nor frequently dressed in all his garments, means with all the clothes on taking bath. That shouldn't be done very often. Generally that is done after, one of them is called the Avabrita Snan, after performance of big sacrifices or big ceremonies. Then the priests and the Yajamans, they will take their bath with all their clothes on. Like that. So that should not be done often in a day. Nor in a pond which he does not perfectly know, because otherwise you may slip or who knows what's inside. Right? 130. Let him not intentionally step on the shadow of the deities, of the guru, of a king, of a snataka, of his teacher, of a reddish-brown animal, or of one who has been initiated in the performance of Shrauta sacrifice, Dikshita. In other words, the shadow is also considered to be the person. Like that, it's his reflection. So out of respect, one doesn't intentionally step on them. One doesn't notice, that's another thing. One notices these things, and one will be a little careful about stepping. As we discussed yesterday, is that the shadow is connected with the person. It's connected, it has influence on the subtle body. Not that if you step on the shadow, anything happens to the person. That's not. But meditating on your own shadow like that is to be avoided. At midday and at midnight, or after taking a meal at a shraddha, and in the twilights, let him not stay long on a crossroad. As we mentioned, that where roads intersect, that point and yakshas and other things, that's their right to stay there. So these times are, their times. Midnight, middle of the day, then after having a funeral dinner, because that's generally going through their medium, so then they might like to catch you and give you some trouble. Or at the twilights, generally those times. Because also twilights, the perception is not good. You can't see properly distances. And also that's the time when all these personalities are either like waking up or going to sleep. In the morning, they're just like heading out, and they may be going to these spots or moving through these spots. And in the night, then they're just coming out like that. They live, 80 miles? How far is it? 100 miles? I think their planets are like about 100 miles from here, from Mars. Upwards, yeah. Like that. They're very close. Like that. So for them, it's not a whole big trouble to come. Yes?
When you say middle of the day, is that halfway between sunrise and sunset?
Yeah, it means halfway between. So you calculate like that. I mean, we generally will say that means 12 o'clock, but it means when the sun is straight up. Like that, so that maybe whatever time that is. It's just one doesn't loiter at that. It's an auspicious time. When the sun is directly up, that's what Abhijit. Abhijit Muhurta. So 24 minutes before that, 24 minutes after. That's considered very auspicious. If you don't have any other auspicious time to start something or do something, then that time is considered very, very favorable. But it's also these person's time that they can, move about. They get the like that. Let him not step intentionally on things used for cleaning the body, on water used for a bath, on urine, on blood, or any other impure substance. Let him not show particular attention to any enemy, to the friend of an enemy, to a wicked man, to a thief, or to the wife of another man. For in the world there is nothing so detrimental to long life as criminal conversation with another man's wife. Let him who desires prosperity indeed never despise a kshatriya, a snake, and a learned Brahmin, be they ever so feeble. Because they can all get you. Very practical. Don't bother a king, a snake, or a learned Brahmin. It may seem they're not very strong, but snake, doesn't matter how big it is, Even the baby snakes, actually, their poison is stronger than the big snakes. Like that. So then, like that. Brahmins, because they're clever. What's his name? Chanakya. I don't think he could move properly. Isn't it? I think it was like he was kind of like partially crippled and was not very attractive at all. I think he was quite unattractive physically. So then Maharaj Nanda, then he was a lover of beauty. He was a gross materialist. And they were having some kind of competition, I think poetics or something. And then Chanakya spoke the most eloquent verses. So the king was very pleased, and he wanted to see who it was that won the competition. But when he saw Chanakya, you know, he got very upset. You know, it's not possible that someone who is so unattractive as this person could be the winner of this competition. You know, and he was very upset. So then Chanakya, he cursed him. He says, you know, that your dynasty will be finished. And in that shock, then Chanakya disappeared, because he's clever. And when everybody kind of came to, then when they went looking for him, he was already gone. And sure enough, it took him 8 years, but he enthroned Chandragupta on the throne. And but through his expert understanding of the politics, or the kingly politics. In this way, even though he himself personally didn't do anything, he destroyed Nanda's whole dynasty and established Chandragupta as the emperor. So he looked very feeble, according to Maharaj Nanda's perception. But this person completely destroyed him. So like that, one should be very careful. Because a king is known for his influence, not his physical strength. Right? For a king, it's his influence. Kshatriya is respected according to his influence. Like that. Someone who can influence a great amount of people, that has to be respected. They may be very small. Mahatma Gandhi was a real small character. Like that, you know. What is it? Half-naked fakir, right? That's what they used to call him in England. But he removed the, you know, 250 years rule of the English from India, just sitting there and spinning his cloth or fasting or speaking. So physically he didn't do anything. But like this, someone has to be very careful. Influence should never be So the king, even though physically he doesn't look strong, like Bhima had the strength of 10,000 elephants, but Arjuna didn't. Neither did Yudhishthira. That was only Bhim, Duryodhana, Kichika, Jarasandha, and Dhritarashtra. These five. They had strength of 10,000 elephants. So you'd think, yes, big, strong Kshatriyas. But, you know, Arjuna didn't, Yudhishthira didn't. But they're the ones who became Yudhishthira became the emperor. So don't underestimate. Let him not despise himself on account of former failures. Until death, let him seek fortune, not despair of gaining it. Means if one has failed, one doesn't think I'm useless, this, that, get all mental and all this. This is not brahminical, because this is the mode of ignorance. This is lamentation. And there's a certain pleasure in it, thinking that I'm so disgusting and so terrible, and fully absorbing myself and thinking about myself, how terrible I am. Right? But the point is here is that we make mistakes. We understand is that we had the desire, but the Lord did not sanction. So due to our, you know, disqualification, but we must become qualified. So he should not despair gaining what his goals are. So if he is desiring that, okay, we'll become very strict in our sadhana or become a good preacher, expert in anything, doesn't happen. He always thinks that we will gain. Then he will always learn. So a teacher must be someone who's always learning. Right? As soon as you stop learning, you factually stop becoming a teacher. Right? You're a student in the beginning. because you don't know anything. But once you know something, then what you know you teach, and what you don't know you continue to study. And as long as he is studying and learning, he's a teacher. And as soon as he gives up study, then actually then you can gain something from them, but they're not actually the best quality teacher. So the Vedic concept was the teachers must be of the best standard. So they must be someone who is always studying, always continuing, like that. So therefore, it says, up until death, let him seek that, and he will gain it. He didn't get it today? Okay. Doesn't matter. Like that. He'll always endeavor. This is, we understand that in the youth, and it's specifically just knowledge, in the middle of life, then it may be for developing the household and all that, though he's still studying. And at the end, then it'll be detachment. So the various things that he is desiring, then must be seen, but that knowledge must always be endeavored for. Let him say what is true. Let him say what is pleasing. Let him utter no disagreeable truth. And let him utter no agreeable falsehood. That is the eternal law. Yeah. Okay. He must say what is true. But what he says, it must be said in a pleasing way. So therefore, if the truth is going to be very disturbing to the person who is hearing it, and it's not our position to speak to them in that way, we're not their teacher, we're not their, you know, we're not in some way accepted by them as their guide, then even a disagreeable truth shouldn't be spoken. It should be said in a light way that the person will not necessarily catch it. Truth is spoken, but it may be in a you may use euphemisms, you know, you may lighten it. Because the person, you say the truth, they're not going to be benefited, and they're only going to feel bad, and may feel bad towards you, like this. And he should say, utter no agreeable falsehood. Falsehood means the person wants to hear something else, so therefore you say something just to please him, though it's false. That also is not done. In other words, if one sees that the person is not able to accept the truth, he just basically takes the neutral standpoint. Doesn't speak anything heavy, doesn't speak anything false. But he must dedicate himself to speaking what is actual, the proper truth, the philosophy, and seeing everything in connection with that. So this is an important rule. The idea of that here is be straightforward, be open, I tell you everything I think about you, and it's very unpalatable and this and that. That's not for the Brahmins. Because by doing that, then you just disturb things even more. Because that's my perception. My perception of what I think is bad about someone else may be very subjective on my part. You know, according to my likes, dislikes, or my conditioning, I'll say it's bad. Someone else will say it's great. So when I say I'm being truthful, that means truthful means I'm telling you what my mind thinks. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's truth. So here, truth means, what is true means what is according to the Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. That it must be spoken. But so many different levels can be spoken. It means for someone who's very, very, very fixed, then you can get into very fine points, critical points. Someone who's not very fixed, then you'll take the more gentle and more encouraging. They're all truth. It's just like learning how to add is truth. And learning calculus is truth. But you can't teach a first grader calculus. Right? So therefore, both are truth. So the very encouraging, simple presentation is truth. So that's given to that person, who that will benefit him. And for that person, you can speak very fine, critical points that really makes one really have to think. Then one says those for that person. So it has to be very, it must hear, it says it must be pleasing. So it means the person must be satisfied. So it must be according to the person that he's speaking to. It must be according to the audience. Then that is austerity of the tongue. Otherwise, we just speak whatever we like, and we disturb everyone. And we can say, well, it's Shastra, you know, if they don't accept, what can I say? But the Shastra also says that don't speak in such a way as to disturb the other person. Says, let him not engage in a useless enmity or dispute with anybody. It means if it's, there's no gain. It's simply it's the ego. You just want to prove that I'm right and he was wrong. That has no meaning. And no use to get involved in that. Says, let him not journey too early in the morning, nor too late in the evening, nor just during the midday heat, nor with an unknown company, nor alone, nor with unqualified men. Because otherwise, these times, one doesn't know what will happen when it's maybe not proper. Unknown people, so many things they can do. Let him not insult those who have redundant limbs or are deficient in limbs, nor those destitute of knowledge, nor very aged men, nor those who have no beauty or wealth, nor those who are of low birth. Who have redundant limbs means they have too many. You know, some have six fingers or stuff like that. Or deficient limbs. They don't have, you know, missing. So, in other words, those things which we would normally take as something, you know, if means wealth, power, beauty, knowledge, renunciation, influence, all these things, if someone doesn't have them, then we do not speak badly about them. We should not insult them. It means we don't, because these are all material things. The Brahman is not supposed to be worried about the material aspects. He's supposed to be worried about the Shastras, what is given by the Lord, what is the directions of the Lord. That is his interest, and how to train others in it. So he doesn't worry about the people look nice or don't look nice or this or that. We don't. That's not the basis. Brahmana who is impure must not touch with his hand a cow, a brahmana, or fire, nor being in good health, let him look at the luminaries in the sky while it's impure. So then, when one's impure, means all these are respectable, cows, brahmins, and fire. So when he's not clean, he shouldn't touch them. And nor being in good health, let him not look at the luminaries while he is impure. Because when one is in good health, one's impure, and then one goes about purifying oneself. Like one's gone to the toilet, one will go about purifying himself. But if he's sick, then that's another thing, because you may be laying on your back and looking at the luminaries above you. I mean, there's not much, and you may not be in a pure state, but there's nothing you can do. But if he's healthy, then one will avoid, because the luminaries, all different people stay on that, all different demigods and respectable people, like the North Pole, that's Dhruva Maharaj and Kiradakshaya Vishnu live there, and then on the Big Dipper, the Sapta Rishis, they all live there, and all the moon, the sun, then all your nakshatras, they're all the wives of the moon. So, these are all their planets. So when we're impure, then when one's healthy, that impure state is not maintained for long, few minutes. So during that time, one avoids looking at them. But if one is unhealthy, then that's another thing. Because then, you know, one may not be able to properly purify himself for some time. Except when sick, he must not touch the cavities of the body without a reason, and he must avoid to touch the hair on the secret parts. Because all these are, well, he'll become contaminated. Let him eagerly follow the customs which are auspicious and the rule of good conduct. Be careful of purity and control all his organs. Let him mutter prayers and untired daily offer oblations in the fire. No calamity happens to those who eagerly follow auspicious customs and the rule of good conduct, to those who are always careful of purity, and to those who mutter sacred texts or offer burnt oblations. In other words, those who always follow the proper Vaishnava etiquette, the culture, the culture is given to us by the Acharya, who is always, you know, maintaining the standards of purity, who's always established nicely in their service, their preaching, their sadhana, then everything works very nicely for them. But if not, then let him without tiring daily mutter the Veda at the proper time, for they declare that to be one's highest duty. All other observances are called secondary duties here. So we see here chanting, because the Veda is full of the Lord's names. So the recitation of the sacred texts, you know, the Bhagavatam, the Gita, other, and chanting of the holy name, then this is said to be the highest duty, the most important. And everything else is secondary. We see the same point is made. By daily reciting the Veda, by the observance of the rules of purification, by practicing austerities, by doing no injury to created beings, one obtains the faculty of remembering former births. He who recollected his former existences again recites the Veda, gains endless bliss by the continual study of the Veda. Means one who understands the previous, means by one understands where one is coming from. One starts to see, because as one advances, then one must be aware of one's conditioning. And one understands these conditionings are coming from last life. So one starts to understand the activities that must have been performed in the last life. Then, knowing this, he understands these things must be given up, and how fortunate we are to be able to be in a position to be able to chant the holy name, associate with devotees, hear the Bhagavatam. So then one gets so much happiness from doing these activities, and not by material activities. Because these material activities have just given us problem, birth after birth after birth. So seeing what is the nature of these previous, and then this is coming from recitation of the Veda. Means by our chanting, by our service, and one starts to connect them together. One starts to see that certain threads of desires, they continue, are always there in the life, and they go from when one is, you know, like when one's young, one does things, when one's older, one does things. We notice certain things may adjust, but there's certain things that always continue through. So we understand these go back. So one is able to discern and see these by the devotional process. Otherwise, one is not able to see like that. Even if one hears, even you have those who can reveal the previous lives, it doesn't mean that we'll be able to do anything with it. Because it's not until we see the connection in this life, right? We hear in this last life I was this, the one before I was that. But unless you can see how that has created the difficulties we have now, what's the benefit? That's the benefit of knowing the past life, unless you can connect that because of those attachments. One, I'm still here. I didn't go back to Godhead already. And two, this is creating the anartas that we have now. So one has to be, yeah. So by mechanical methods, it's not, that is, there's no great benefit. But by understanding from spiritual, then one gets happy. And then it's saying that he should keep his house very pure. So if the facility is there, then far from the living place, that should be the place where one, you know, one has the toilets, one, you know, washes the feet and all the water for that comes to all the bath water and all these things, you know, the dirty water, what is it called, was it gray water? Then all that should not come out close to the house. It should be some distance away. Like that. So it's also recommending here that early in the morning, that's the best time to avoid the bowels. Right, decorate the body. Yeah. It's the best time for worshiping the Lord, brushing the teeth. That's the best time for these things, because when at this time one is taking one's bath anyway, that generally means that the stomach is working properly. Whatever one's taken the day before has been properly digested, so then the body clears that out in the morning. If it doesn't, that means the digestion is not working properly, or we're not properly regulated. Either eating too much, too little, the wrong kind of food, like that. Then the early morning, then our bathing, that should be done in the early morning, cleaning of the teeth, then worshiping the deity. Right after bathing and cleaning properly, then that time in the morning is the best time for worshiping the deity, the Brahma Muhurta, because the concentration is the best. Questions on this so far? Yes.
It said that one should not step on the shadow of the guru. What about the camera photographs? What is happening in the process of taking a photograph? Is some part of the entity being...
No, there's no part being taken like that, but then one would be careful, one wouldn't step on such a photo. And if it is a photo of someone respectable or the deities, one would keep it properly like the deities. But it's not that a portion is taken like that. But it's just because the point is these respectable persons, that element of respect is actually coming from the Lord. It means Krishna is the guru. And then he comes in the heart. He is the guru. Because we're not able to hear from him, then he comes in so many external manifestations. He comes he comes as the deity, he comes as the scriptures, he comes as the the spiritual master, other senior persons. He comes, whoever is instructing us like this. So a portion of his energy, this respectful energy, means he is the most famous, he's the most powerful, like that. Whatever is there is that we respect people for, it's all coming from Krishna. So a portion of that is, it's so what is there in the thought is a portion of Krishna. That energy of Krishna, that potency of Krishna is there. But it comes to us through that person. That's how we are gaining it. And so Krishna expects you also, because he's personal. He's expanded everything just to interface with the devotees. So he expects us to interface with those persons. So Guru is one, whoever is telling us these things, and that's one, because it is actually Krishna is the Guru. And he is approaching us through different personalities. But he expects us, because he's a person, he expects us to deal with these people personally. So even though we know the tattva, that the spiritual master represents God, but at the same time, he is a person, and we have a relationship we must deal with him is in that personal relationship. So both the etiquette and the tattva have to be in place. Otherwise, if one only has one and not the other, there's a problem. If he has the etiquette, but he doesn't know the philosophy, it'll be sentiment. And if he knows the philosophy, but not the etiquette, it'll be mental speculation. Because then one can always think of different ways of this and that and so many different things. But if you know the etiquette, then you know I deal in this way. Spiritual master is as good as God, and I deal with him in this way. Otherwise, if I just know I respect Guru and worship Guru, but actually don't understand how he's representing God, it's sentiment. It's nice, but it's not complete. If we know he represents God, but because that aspect that he represents God, we respect that, but we don't respect him as a person. And that's also not complete. So it must be, both must be there.
Parashurama mentions that on Chaturdasi and Navamayam Chaturdasi, unless you put Namashtam, we don't study new things in the Vedas. They don't study because that's for the teacher, that's for the student. These rules, will we look upon them as like the rules previously mentioned before?
Yes, means all these things which there's a limit on the things, generally, you'll see, at least this style of limit, you know, is referring to those things which are aparavidya. Means transcendental knowledge, these rules don't apply. Right? At any time, place, practically. It means you can study. Read the Bhagavatam. You know, you don't read in the toilet, you know, you don't keep a nice book rack there with the Bhagavad Gita and Bhagavatam while you're on the toilet and you're studying. You know, like that. In other words, aspects of purity are maintained, but these times are not important. Like that. That doesn't mean, in other words, those studying transcendental subject matter for the purpose of transcendence, these rules don't apply, because transcendence is another thing. Those who are studying the aparavidya, or the Veda and these branches of knowledge, with the purpose of material benefit, then they have to not study on these times. Otherwise, the personalities that are involved will not be pleased, and their abilities to actually gain any benefit at these times will be wasted. You know? Because everybody has so many things they want to do, isn't it? little things. And then, because he's supposed to study, he'll get into that, but you also become frustrated when these little things don't get taken care of. So when you have those times, okay, we don't study now, you know, so for this day we don't study, then he'll take care of all, because the Brahman says he doesn't waste his time. He does not idly waste his time. And he'll do all the little things, you know, he's always wanted to put his books in order, or go through, you know, his closet, you know, and throw things out, or give it in charity. You know, when do you get the time? So these are the times. And then you can do all these little things. So these are done. But for the transcendentalist, then the consideration of not doing it because there will not be any material fruits the fruits of piety will not come, are not considered at all. Right? They're not considered at all. It's understood that those days may not be the best for someone who is conditioned to study. But that doesn't mean that they can't. It just means it'll be more difficult to study on those days. So therefore, then they may use those days for other work. Right? It means in a week you may have to do some take time to do other activities than study. Right? So then one will take advantage of these days because they're not as the student will not be as attentive. Right? But for transcendental literature, there's no rule you can't study it then. Isn't it? Like that. Yes.
Maharaj, we see that acharyas like Madhva and Ramanuja follow these rules.
Yeah.
They are transcendentalists. So were they following the rules particularly because of the level of students they were teaching?
Yes. It would be because you see with Ramanuja and Madhva very strongly, because they were just coming in after, you know, you have Buddha and then after Shankara to reestablish the Vedic culture. So they would emphasize the aspect of performance of prescribed duties. By performing those prescribed duties, then one could advance nicely. So if one's going to Vaikuntha, that does help a lot. Because Vaikuntha is based on Vidhi. And the Vidhi that's here is coming from there. So for them, it's very natural. All they have to do is add into it that they're doing this Vidhi for the Lord. And then everything becomes very nice. So we also follow the same basic principles, but because our goal is on another platform, is Vrindavan. Therefore, the rules themselves don't take the precedence. So we use the rules as a means of purification. So those rules that are specifically will bring us to the point that they, and then they drop off. Then those are emphasized like that. Or I mean, yeah, means those which are useful, and then they may be discarded. But those which you'll maintain, like chanting the holy name, chanting, associating with devotees, always hearing the glories of the Lord, always worshiping the Lord, always living in the Lord's place, right? I mean, in Vrindavan, they're living in the holy dham, right? Krishna is their deity; they're worshiping him. They're always associating with other devotees. They're always chanting the Lord's glories. Right? And they're always chanting the Lord's name. So these are always going on. Like that. Enthusiastic kirtan. Sounds like they're playing anything, all their plates and bowls and the lockers. And once I was at one devotee's house, and he lived on the other side of the Gurukul kitchen. And then in the evening, about 8:30, we hear this nice kirtan. There's all these amazing instruments, you know. And so then we go over to check, you know, from a distance where boys couldn't see, you know. Someone's got, you know, a big cooking pot and is beating on that, another on a lid. Someone else has the mortar and pestle, they're playing that, and someone else has some spoons and they're playing so many things and like that. It was a whole, they just took everything in the kitchen and was making kirtan with it. So it is a popular, these are the eccentricities, natural eccentricities of boys. They like these things. Anything else? On? no other questions, we'll end here. You have? You have one, but you can't word it.
But I can't remember. I was going to ask it about the rule that a frog jumps between the teacher and the student. I don't know if it's here.
Yeah.
They should stop class. Or will it be also like? Is the rule like from here, or is it just like an experience?
No, no,
the
no,
teacher
no.
Is recorded or it's a
no, no. There's a whole list of them.
It is in there somewhere.
We went across it. Know that this Vedic study must be interrupted for a day and a night when cattle, a frog, a cat, a dog, a snake, a lizard, or a rat pass between the teacher and his pupil.
All together?
Yeah, well, if they all can, then you definitely know it's time to stop class. You know. But this means that the teacher and students, where they're studying, is something goes in between them. Just like that, because what it signifies is that the concentration of the students, you know, that's it. You might as well pack up 24 hours. Now, if they're serious devotees, especially if they're initiated devotees, then anyone finds this, it doesn't have the effect. But if they're not, or they're not so serious, then one will find it has the effect. I've seen it myself. I was teaching mantras and that, and then a frog went between us, and all the boys who were like good in their sadhana and serious in that, their concentration remained, and those who weren't, that was it. They couldn't concentrate one more word like that. So I've seen it practically does it. It just signifies not that the frog does something, it just means that, you know, that's it, you know. Mind this does not. It's, there's something in the atmosphere that's creating it. Who's that? So it just depends who you're teaching. You're teaching the monsters, then you might stop the class. Because generally they get too involved in it. Also, the frogs are going by and they're all into the frog. Like that. You know. And if it's the, you know, Bhakti Shastri class, you generally don't have to worry. You know, you just might start telling more stories. Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.